You're listening to the Strong Towns Podcast.
Hey, everybody, this is Chuck Marone. Welcome back to the Strong Towns Podcast. I've got a special guest today, Majora Carter. She's an urban revitalization strategist, real estate developer, MacArthur Fellow, Peabody Award winning broadcaster, owner of the Boogie Down Grind Cafe, and author of this amazing book, Reclaiming Your Community. You don't have to move out of your neighborhood to live in a better one. Majora comes to us today from the Bronx, her home. Welcome to the Strong Towns Podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
This is our second go at this. The first one was interrupted by your beautiful life, including sounds out the window and puppies barking and all kinds of frivolity. So I want you to know I'm happy to do this.
No problem. Thank you for being so amenable.
Yeah, well, we're a very dog-friendly organization. We have a lot of meetings with pets around and little kids and all kinds of stuff. So it's all good. Yeah. Joy, you are coming to us from the Bronx right now, right?
Yes, I am.
I found your book to be so captivating and so fascinating. And I think, you know, one of the things I wanted to explore with you was just how, you know, for me, living in small town America, a couple hours north of Minneapolis, a very white community, a very rural community, I felt so much connection to the story you were telling about your place, which seems very different than mine. Can you maybe start with the idea of the brain drain and just the whole concept of how to be successful in your place? The expectation was that you leave.
Mm-hmm. Yes. America is sort of fascinated by the Cinderella story, you know, of, you know, someone growing up in, say, a hardscrabble neighborhood, you know, being scrappy but smart and, you know, moving on up and out, you know, to accomplish great things. And, you know, we actively challenge that notion, because if people, we know that there's talent in all of those neighborhoods, but in those communities, whether it's they're rural or urban or suburban or exurban or whatever, but there's this, you know, dynamic that they're not, people aren't supposed to stay there. And it's like, why not? Just really, why not? And why do we take our talents and go enrich someone else's? And so we call those type of communities low status. Not, we don't refer to them as poor, impoverished, or under-resourced or underprivileged or anything like that, because status actually implies that there's something greater at work. And that's just as it is. And in this case, it's that inequality is simply assumed for those places. So again, not that talent isn't born there, but that it's not supposed to stay. And the other piece around it is that the inequality kind of manifests in various ways, like, you know, low educational attainment, you know, higher rates of, you know, bad health outcomes, you know, bad policing, you know, lower property values while those type of people are still living in there. And again, why do we expect that to be the case, whether it's small town America or big urban areas?
And I appreciate your use of the word low status, because it is almost like these places are treated differently, right? Can you maybe talk a little bit about the treatment that comes from the outside? Because then I would like to also talk about the treatment that comes from the inside, maybe how we as people internal to these places tend to look at them. So maybe we start with the outside.
Sure. The interesting about low status community is that inequality is assumed by people both inside and outside the community. And by the folks in the outside the community, I think heavily influenced, you know, by the nonprofit industrial complex, which absolutely does include the business community as well as the government, you know, playing a role, you know, in perpetuating this idea that these communities are essentially intractable problems that will never really be solved. I mean, you can manage them. Manage them in their poverty, but they're always going to be poverty. They're always going to be undereducated and, you know, in ill health. And so you manage for that. And so then you extract the ones that sort of look like they rise above it, you know, and then they go off to greener pastures. And, you know, but again, there's lots of money to be made, you know, from that kind of mentality that, you know, I think the nonprofit industrial complex kind of perpetuates. You know, it's everything from, you know, the presence, you know, of very highly subsidized affordable housing, which developers make, you know, developer fees off of, not necessarily to produce a great product, but to produce, they're making these places where poverty is concentrated, which we know then just adds, you know, to low health outcomes, educational attainment, and all those other issues that we're trying to deal with. But again, if you're concentrating all those things, are they ever going to change? And again, you know, whether it's the health outcomes, it's like there's all sorts of pharmacies and, you know, subsidized health clinics, you know, in low status communities. And again, the multi-billion dollar economic engine that's pharmaceuticals, they do make a lot of money, you know, off the lifestyle illnesses that you often find in American low status communities, diabetes, obesity, heart conditions, all those things. And, you know, again, someone's making money off of the poverty that's present in all these communities. Again, whether they're rural, you know, Native American reservations or, you know, poor white towns where there was industry in the Rust Belt, but not anymore, or inner cities. So again, like, are we creating and continue to perpetuate that dynamic where we're concentrating poverty and someone else is making money off of it? Or can we actually recognize that that's what's happening? And then understand that we don't have to keep, you know, doing the same crazy things that create the same exact outcomes.
It does feel a little like sitting here, and I felt this as I read your story too, that a lot of what is done to help lift my community out of poverty are programs that really work well for the people at City Hall, and they really work well for the people in the NGOs. The latest obsession we have is with a children's museum, because there's a state grant for children's museums. And so now our local regional economic development authority has kind of redefined every struggling family problem in terms of needing a children's museum. And I'm not even going to argue that children's museum isn't good, but it doesn't seem to me to be like the urgent problem. What is going on here? Why are all of the problems that we have being redefined in terms of what can be delivered to us, in a sense?
Because, you know, I think in the case of kids, you know, it's they're easy and they're cute. And who doesn't like children, you know, except, you know, when, you know, they get shot in an elementary school, doesn't mean that we get gun laws out of it. Or if they're in the womb of a poor woman, that's a whole other story. We don't necessarily like them that much. I think that it's an easy out. That means that you don't have to deal with the systemic issues that created all those problems. And it's a feel good kind of thing. And everybody loves cutting a ribbon, but nobody, from where I'm sitting, you know, wants to acknowledge that, yes, it took a long time for us to get to the point where we were this wealth gap, you know, is as big as it is, you know, where the health conditions are as alarming as they are. You know, the community development, you know, is just, we've just spiraled in the same direction, like for as long as I can see. And it's not so easy to do the work around financial literacy, you know, and supporting, you know, folks where they are to be the agents of their own, of the change that they need to see. Because I do believe that we have the keys to our own economic recovery. Right now, we need to do some triage in order to actually make it so that people can literally be what they need to be in terms of their own communities, you know, which is like the people who are going to make the change that they want to see in their neighborhoods. That's hard, you know, and it's not like, you know, if you think about it, you know, 15% of all homes in this country are owned by private equity firms. 15%, you know, and these are not, you know, homes in wealthy areas. These are homes in low status communities of all colors and of all different types of topographies, you know, whether urban or rural or whatever. And taking the opportunity for people to participate in the great American dream of home ownership, that is something that it took a while to get to that point. Actually, I don't think it took that long, to tell you the truth. I'm not exactly sure how long it took, but it seems like it's, you know, I know in the case of my neighborhood, it's only been in the past less than 20 years where, you know, our homeownership rate's gone from, you know, over 20% down to less than 7, you know, for mostly all cash deals. So if we are looking, and if we know that a path to home ownership, you know, is a key to families' economic stability and, you know, reducing the wealth gap and keep making people feel like they've got something to look forward to and something to protect in terms of their own communities, then by literally, you know, creating the infrastructure and the dynamic for private equity and real estate firms, big and small, not even necessarily private equity, but predatory speculation is predatory speculation. I don't care if it's private equity, you know, or bigger firms or smaller firms doing it. It's the same thing. You know, they're capitalizing, you know, off the fact that people in our own communities and in low status communities do not see the value in our own neighborhoods while we're in it. And that should be something that should be alarming, you know, to everyone, you know, who is allegedly there to support, you know, the community development in low status communities, but it's easier to do a children's museum.
It is. It's easier.
And it's not fun. It's cute. It's a great photo op.
It's hard to be against it, right? I feel like when I'm against it, I'm against kids, right?
I know. And that's, yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Before we go on, I want to ask you about a term that you use, because we use it a lot too. And I think people react to it in weird ways. And that is the idea of building wealth. We talk a lot about streets as a platform for building wealth, how neighborhoods, we need to build wealth and capacity within a neighborhood. And when I was reading your book, you kept coming back to this. We need to build wealth. We need to build wealth. And a lot of people, when they hear that, they put on maybe like a white progressive lens, or they put on a you know, charity lens, and they think that building wealth is somehow predatory, like building wealth is somehow exploiting people. What do you mean when you say build wealth?
You know, and I also find it funny that the same people who say that actually have it.
Sure.
It's just like, oh, it's good for you.
Fair point. Yeah.
Really? Hello.
Yeah, really?
Yeah. I once had possibly, I'm not even going to say this, the city that they were in, but this one woman, oh my God, and whose husband and her family just were ridiculous. I mean, like more money than God. And I just started my own company. And she was like, why would you? I mean, literally, this was the look on her face. And so I'm not sure if this is going to be, you know, video or not, but she's like, why would you want to start a for-profit?
Yeah.
And I was like, why it's your family?
Right. Right. Yeah. How do you think you got here? Yeah.
Jesus. And, but then the beauty part, you know, of it. And I do think that this is like part of, you know, the power and effectiveness of white supremacy, frankly, you know, where it, you know, and even though we know, like just statistically, white supremacy doesn't even work for most white people. It works for some of them really well, but most of them, not so much. I mean, biggest victims of gun violence in America, non-inner cities, it's white men by suicide. You know, it's, there are more poor white people than there are people of color, people who are on the public dole. So again, it's not really working. But the interesting thing is that it literally has made, and I think especially in progressive circles, you know, it's made folks believe that somehow money is the enemy. And, but what it really does do is create the opportunity for people who have it to keep it and to make the rest of us feel virtuous by not having any. Or the path that comes actually having the stability, you know, of knowing that you're going to be okay. And that somehow or another, it's better to be in a place of want than it, and rather than in a space of abundance. And I'm not saying that everybody's got to be, you know, super rich, but I definitely, I've been in the position, you know, of being really poor and not, and being hungry, certainly been there. And you know what? Having something more is a little bit better, and everyone deserves it. Everyone deserves it. So
I feel like there's not enough appreciation. We marvel at the difference between Elon Musk and Bill Gates. I don't think we fully appreciate how much difference there is between someone who doesn't have enough for a meal, but has, you know, and someone who has enough to put a, you know, 2 months away of income,
right?
You know, it's that's a radical transformation in capacity.
Right.
Right.
You know, it's like when, and people like to talk about in the developing world, like the difference between somebody making $1 a day versus $5 a day. It can be huge and transformative for their family, but we don't like to play that game. You know, in the States, I've noticed, without like sounding like you're adding these moralistic, you know, ideas to it, which I never understood.
Well, when I look at neighborhoods, it's obvious that there's a lot of wealth there. And it's obvious to me there's a lot of wealth there because there's a lot of things set up around it to extract that wealth. You describe it so well in this book. In chapter 6, you have a chapter called Convenient Prey. If you're not at the table, you're on the menu. And you write, let's be clear, just because many residents in low status communities do not see the value within their own community doesn't mean it isn't there. Others definitely see it. An entire industry banks literally on the current inhabitants in those communities not recognizing the value. Can you elaborate on that? Because I found that to just be like a profound way to say something very beautiful about these places.
Yeah. You know, and you know, people like to think, so there's actually two pieces to that, the way you can look and interpret it. You know, one is there is value, you know, in our communities, in our culture. Like I'm from the South Bronx, like we created hip hop. It's this amazing cultural export. Like I literally just got back, you know, from the cafe that we started, which is like an ode, you know, an homage, you know, to the birth of hip hop. And, you know, talking with some young artists who are going to be selling, you know, their work, you know, to collectors at our cafe. And I'm just like, I want to see them. I want to see them make lots of money, you know, off of it. I think it's awesome. But at the same time, we are led to believe that things like, you know, oh, when you start to see things like doggy daycares or cute cafes in communities, it's because that's when gentrification starts. Gentrification starts long before that. It happens when people start believing that there's no value in our communities while we're in them. So that's why we literally built places like the Boogie Down Grind as a way to remind people like, nah, we definitely have something worth investing in, worth supporting, and worth loving. Literally just by you guys walking in here. Literally just by you guys walking in here. And I feel like that's something that we tend to forget. And our ability to sort of share, you know, create this space for people to come in and fill has been, I think, a beautiful asset, because all it does is put a mirror up to people and just remind them. It's like, no, you are that beautiful right here, right now. And let's have some fun while we're here.
We've thrown out two terms here that are evidently related for you and me. I don't know if they're evidently related for everybody else. One of them is wealth and wealth creation, like I talked about earlier. And you just said the term beauty and being beautiful. I think a lot of people who think about wealth in a community measure it in terms of how many buildings do you have? What is their net absolute value? What is the cash flow through? You, throughout this book, have an a way of equating community wealth and value with beauty and esteem and other things that I think are self-evident, but I don't think a lot of people connect real well.
No.
Can you connect those for us? Because it feels like your work is doing this like astounding job of connecting those things. At least that's what I took from your book. It was just the beauty of that.
Thank you. That's lovely. And I'm so glad you took that because yes, you know, I think, you know, humans have this thing, you know, where we're attracted to beautiful things, right? It's even when you think about the way towns were started. Often it was near a body of water. You know, there was a public square. You know, there were places where people could sell stuff. People could gather. There were churches. I mean, in this area that made people feel like, okay, we're around. And if there was, a particular sense of an aesthetic, often dictated by the natural environment. But then, you know, you created the built environment around it to meet the social and the economic needs of the people that were there. And you know, and people like when you think about like some of the earliest, you know, architecture, I've got this beautiful book. The name, of course, escapes me, but it was something like, you know, gosh,
I hate when that happens,
but it was just, yeah. You know, it's like a new way of seeing. And basically all this, it was a photography book, and all this photographer did was literally go to like small towns in America and look at how people, you know, and then there were old towns, you know, all they did was just like, you know, how they basically would create flourishes on buildings. It was the most mundane buildings, but they were just designing them so that it was just like, I was here. I want you to see what I can do as a craftsperson. And I feel like we are creators. Like we are what? Like one of the few species that actually responds in that way and can show like, okay, I'm either attracted or repulsed, you know, by things. And so of course our environment around us tells us that. So why are we not creating more beauty so that people can feel pride in it? Because if you don't feel pride in it, then it's easy. Then yeah, it's easy for a predatory speculator to walk up to your home, to your house and say, I'll take this off your hands and I'll buy cash right now. And they're like, this whole thing, that's if you don't see any value in it, you think that the other guy's a sucker, but they don't know.
Right, right.
You don't know that they can see the writing on the wall. And, you know, and you know, my own family, you know, was included in that. You know, when both my parents passed, you know, we had the house in the family since the 1940s. And so three generations of my family, you know, were raised at least in part, you know, in that house. You know, when they both passed away, I could not get my siblings. I'm the youngest of 10, so nobody listened to me. And I couldn't get anybody to see the value in keeping the family home. And now it's worth three times more than it was sold for.
It's hard to judge our families for that too, isn't it?
No, I judge them.
Well, let me...
I just don't talk about it, you know, at holiday dinners. I do not do. You're right.
Let me put it this way. It's easy to understand how they come to that conclusion, right? And I guess this is maybe the next thing I want to talk about, or I want to hear you describe, because you clearly are a very successful person. And I know, and some of this came from your book, but some of this is just obvious. I know people in your community recognized early on that this is someone who's going somewhere. So let's prep her. Let's get her ready to escape this place and go far, far away. And the same mentality that would do that out of love would actually, I think, find it very easy to sell the family home. Can you relate those two mindsets and why we need to, because I love those people who do that. I mean, my family did that for me, right? Go forth. I don't think that was right.
Right.
Can you explain why?
They were doing the best they could.
Yes.
And the best they could was to look at our communities and see a lack of value and potential for themselves. But that was by design. That's the thing. That is by design, because there isn't a place in this country where somebody doesn't tell the same exact story that I told. You know, in my book about we are led to believe that, you know, there's no value in our community, that you measure success by how far you get away from it. Even before I wrote my book, you know, I've been, you know, traveling and, you know, doing lectures and consulting around the country. And I have to tell you, it's rare that I don't find somebody from the Bronx.
Wow. Wow.
It's very strange. And they all have this like you can see it in their eyes when they come up and talk to me, you know, after I talk about the work that we're up to. And it's just sort of like, you know, I left too. And it's what like tears me apart is not, I'm, there is no, okay. I mean, I can judge my family because I don't really judge my family.
Well, I know what you mean. Yeah.
but
it hurts, doesn't it?
It's a little bit. It's true. But it's more like, I can't blame people. It's just sort of like, it was powerful, you know, if you're growing up and then you literally see your community on the nightly news being like the worst place, like you were the poster child for urban blight. Of course, you know, and if you're told that there's no possibility and no potential where you are, again, I don't care if it's like an all white, you know, former, you know, Rust Belt town, you know, or an inner city, you're going to believe like, I got to grow up and get out of here. And so that's those are powerful things that people get told from their earliest days. So why would I not think you want to leave? But now, if given this information, and then everybody's just like, oh, right, because you're right. You know, the same place that I left when I was a kid, now it's like XYZ, and it's really, it's like the hot part of town, and that we wouldn't even go there when we were a kid. And now I'm like, so maybe we should rethink community development and ways that actually support people while they're there. That's all. That's all. Yeah, it's an interesting.
Can I read another quote to you?
Sure.
You have this ending of this one chapter where you talk about any club that won't accept me, I don't want to be part of, or I can't remember exactly. I'm going to flip back and find it. Note to self, don't try to be part of any club that doesn't want you as a member. And it was a very powerful way to end this chapter. And the last paragraph here, you say Black folks are not meant to be trusted, not with money, not even with their own lives. And especially not if they are using their lives and money in the service of others like them. I read that and I realized that you are talking about your experience in the Bronx. I'm reading this and I'm seeing North Brainerd, Northeast Brainerd, South, the community that I live in, and how every remedy that we have for those places or every approach we have assumes that the people who live there not only have no capacity today or no real worth today, but they can't possibly develop it, right?
Exactly. And how's that make you feel?
Oh my gosh, it's horrible. When you say you see people from the Bronx everywhere you go, it's a little like, you know, you see Walmart executives doing well, and you see the Walmart extracting all the wealth from the community. You see the dollar store profit margins doing well, and you see the dollar store like sucking wealth out of the community. But when I see the people who have left and are gone, I'm like, that's more valuable than any dollar amount we wasted at Walmart buying crap, right?
Right, right. And it's really interesting because, you know, I think one of the reasons why, you know, the big reason why we built our cafe is because we ask people, like, you know, why are you leaving, you know, the community, you know, or do you want to? And people were really clear, you know, in terms of the survey results that we got. It wasn't because of crime, which it wasn't even, you know, because of like environmental issues. You know, actually our crime rate keeps dropping, which is pretty significant, you know, but then the environmental issues, that wasn't a real issue either. Really, it was lifestyle infrastructure. There was no place for them to hang out and be cool. No cafes, you know, no bars. You know, we do have parks because I actually built the first
nap. Well, I want to ask you about that.
Yeah.
But keep going.
and then we realize if we have the only hope we have of helping people in our own community see the value of being in our own community is to build places that they'd want to be in. And, you know, I couldn't start with housing. I tried. But the next thing we could do was actually build places that people would want to frequent. And having a really cool cafe that most people would think, you know, you would never find in the South Bronx, because they wouldn't, because nobody was building it. You build it here and use it as a platform for people to build their own, you know, ideas of what should happen here. So whether their people are doing open mics or art exhibits, or even, you know, another local couple, they're doing home ownership readiness help for people, and, you know, set up office hours literally at a table in my cafe. And we'll talk to anybody, you know, who wants to talk about, like, what do you do to get ready, you know, for, you know, to get your credit ready, to be ready for to buy a house. Might not be now, but it will happen. So right. Get ready.
There's a strain of thought. I think you can draw a line from Richard Florida and the creative class, that it's pioneering people like you who go in and create the park out of a dump and, you know, buy the Amtrak building and renovate it and make something of it. These are astounding. I mean, these are just amazing stories. And I want people to read this book and get these stories, because these are things that everybody not to diminish what you've done. I want to ask you about that too, but like everybody can do these. These are not like unreachable things, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
It astonishes me. Yeah. Cause it's like nothing that special. I mean, other than everybody's special. But
these are not things out of reach for any community across a country that finds themselves in low status, right? But if you listen to some of the academics and the others, they will say these are the first rumblings of gentrification. These are the first like tremors of gentrification, and almost like mobilize. You rolled your eyes and people can't see it on the podcast, but that was beautiful. But you kind of mobilize this whole group of cadre of people to stand up and say, you know, not here, never. Why is what you're doing so essential and not just the tremors of gentrification, you know, pending gentrification?
I mean, I do find it so just crazy that people believe that folks in low status communities don't want a great community. And quite frankly, you know, people leave when they can, they leave neighborhoods like ours to go live in those exact type of neighborhoods. So we essentially are encouraging the idea of displacing ourselves, like the talent in our own selves, which could reinvest in our own communities, which could supply an amazing model for what others in our communities could be. And that there's somehow something wrong with wanting something wonderful in your own neighborhood. Like, I'm sorry, we did hundreds and hundreds of surveys and asked people, you know, what are you looking for? I mean, because basically it seems like poverty is like almost a cultural attribute when the nonprofit industrial complex, actually some, not all academics, because some academics are actually using my book in their urban planning classes, which I am totally excited about.
Fantastic.
Yes, at University of New Orleans, at Notre Dame. There's a bunch of other places, which is in direct contrast to, you know, some that I will not name publicly, you know, who actually talk about me like a cautionary tale.
And I'm
like, y'all.
Okay.
They've never, I mean, this is the funny thing, is they all know exactly how to get in touch with me, but they don't, because they'd rather talk about me rather than to me. So I'm like, you just keep doing that, baby. Well, we will keep rolling on. And that's that. But it's exciting because, you know, what I know to be true is because I actually bother to talk to people other than myself in the little circle that only the echo chamber that I find a lot of folks that are too afraid to actually engage with me live in, you know, is that people are really proud of their community actually being better. Nobody wants to be considered the butt of jokes. Nobody wants their neighborhood, you know, to be the place that's like a poster child for like what's wrong with our country. Nobody, who wants that? Poverty is not a cultural attribute. It is, I mean, but just because some people, you know, have figured out that you can make a game and a very profitable game of neighborhood preservation using that as a community development strategy, you know, go for it. I mean, they have, you know, that's why we're in the crappy situation that we're in right now.
I'm grateful you said that. I want people to hear a little bit about the park and a little bit about Amtrak building, because both of these were, I could picture you in both instances, in a sense, stumbling onto something that everybody else would have thought was crazy.
Yeah.
And I want the story, but I also want to ask you about that, because it feels like there's a certain element of unleashing crazy that needs to happen. Right. And I'm I say that with reverence.
You're not,
I mean,
the first
I feel
person
like
who said that about me.
Okay. Your thought process, right, that makes you get drug onto a landfill by your dog, resulting in, hey, this could be something. It seems to me like we have to have a way to scale that insight, right? Like we have to have more people be able to have similar paths to inspiration. So can we talk about yours? How did you, what made you look at a dump and say, this is something more?
You know, it actually wasn't the dump. You know, I keep being reminded of this. I don't know if they still make this drug, but it was a drug that was formulated to give to pregnant women while they were in labor. And the goal of it was not that they didn't feel the pain, but that they didn't remember it.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, don't know about that.
Really weird. But, and I remember reading a story about that when I was a kid and just being like, why? Like, you're in, like, she's in pain, like, stop that. But anyway, I never forgot that. But I felt the same way. Like, you know, when I made it through, so when my dog, you know, pulled me into what I thought was just another illegal garbage dump. I mean, it was an illegal garbage dump. However, you know, when I discovered that that dump dead ended at this beautiful expanse of a river that I'd never seen before, because you couldn't, because there was a dump in the way.
Because no one cared a damn about the neighborhood to actually have you connect to the river. I know this is, yes, you're saying.
Yeah, I was just like, what dump?
Right.
I mean, it was just like, I was just looking, you know, at this 150, you know, beautiful piece of water that in the morning, early morning light was just extraordinary. And I was like, oh yeah, this is it. This here is what I'm looking at right now is that, and you know, maybe some of it came from, you know, I still am an artist. And that, you know, when you're, you know, a writer, so when you look at, you know, a blank piece of paper, you're not really thinking about, oh, this is going to stay blank. You're like, what am I going to put on it? And that's what it's going to be. And so for me, it was just like, oh, this is another canvas, or it's a blank sheet of paper. And what we do with it is up to us. And so the vision was always kind of crazy. It just seemed fun. And so, yeah, I like having fun. And I think that's a good part of me.
I will tell you that there's some abandoned buildings or rundown buildings in my community that I have looked at and said, the owner of this building is a railroad or is an institution or is someone who like doesn't care about me. And I'm not going to spend my time trying to do something here because of that. Now I'm rethinking all of that. Can you talk about the building that you recaptured and reclaimed?
Sure. Yeah. And I don't even think I put this in the book, but I absolutely remember the day when I was like, oh yeah, I was looking out the window of my office, which the view of it was at the corner and it was a sort of a round building. So you could see like 180 degrees. And so on one side was this rail station that had been pretty much abandoned at that point. The owner of the ground lease that it was subdivided into several different storefronts had died. Amtrak owned the building. And they, once he died, eventually like all the tenants left, you know, within a year. And so it sat there vacant, you know, and sort of reminded me of the burning Bronx days, you know, from, you know, back in the 70s when I was growing up there. And then I looked to the other side and there was literally within my eye line, just like on one block, there were three pharmacies taking over probably more real estate on that block than anything else, and two health clinics. And I was like, that represents millions and millions and millions of dollars that is based on people's pain. And then in between that was like, you know, a fried chicken joint, you know, and a really skanky deli. And I was just like, oh my God, like this is all we've got. Like this is retail on our main street.
Let's give you cholesterol and then suck out your wealth, treating cholesterol, and just have you like do this cycle around the block.
Totally.
I know. Yes.
And so that's when I looked at that building and I was like, and I'm sick of looking at it. And I found out, I don't even remember how I found this person's email address, but it happened to be like a VP at Amtrak in the real estate department. And I just wrote and said, you know, hey, I'd like to acquire the building. And knowing full well that they probably wouldn't respond. And I'd like was about to make a note in my calendar, contact them once, you know, every couple of weeks. In 2 days, they got back in touch with me. And then I was like, oh, we should figure out.
Well, I love the book. They said, why don't you come by and tell us your plan for the building? And you're like, well, I guess I got to have a plan.
Yeah. So real quick and we pick one up. But that's the thing. It's like when given an opportunity, are you going to take it or are you going to go, no, I can't? And that's what people in low status communities are led to believe that they can't. And no, like who is that benefiting? If we just ask that one question more, like, and when you know that someone is benefiting from your pain.
It feels a lot like the work that you are doing and the work that I see, you know, other, what I would just call heroes in low status communities doing is a full contact sport, right? It's like it's an all in kind of endeavor. I want to ask you a personal question and you don't have to answer this and it might not be fair, but there's a part of me that wants to know, what is it that is special or not special about you? What is it that's replicable that other people could learn from? We're all special, right? I'm with you there, but there's a certain set of characteristic traits that allow some of us, and I'm not even going to include myself in this, but allow some people to like lift their head up above the parapet in a sense and wander out and actually do something. How do we encourage more of that? How do we learn from people like you who have been successful doing this? How do we support them? How do we show them, you know, that we got their back? Like, what do we do to make more of this happen?
Yeah. I mean, we just have to keep it up. You know, I feel like every time, you know, I hear from someone that my example has inspired them, I'm like, it was worth every bit of the pain, every single bit of it, because that just means that folks are not believing this like ridiculous hype that somehow or another they're wrong for wanting better for their communities, health and wealth and well-being. And so by creating, you know, like by supporting me, you know, to do the work that I do and you like people reading my book and going, oh yeah, it's just like literally giving people an opportunity to just question the way things, you know, happen and then going, well, maybe I can do that too. That's what's important to me more than anything. Because I'm getting old and I do hope that, I feel great, but no, I'm going to want a break pretty soon.
Yeah.
And yeah, it just makes me feel so much better to know that there are other folks like going, yeah, we can do this. And the thing is, and that's what's so beautiful is that, you know, I have some, just a few examples, you know, in my book that, you know, folks that are doing it in their own beautiful way, whether it's in, you know, a Native American reservation or even in inner cities, but in their different types of people, you know, but yes, there are often, you know, market-based solutions that where the money circulates throughout the local economy and is benefit, and the chief beneficiaries are people from those communities, because they're the ones actually creating the business opportunities, the, you know, the home ownership opportunities. And that's what's important, because it's always been important in this country, you know, and like smarter people than I have, you know, tried to dismantle capitalism. I'm not trying to dismantle anything. Like, I think you can use it as a tool that it is. And I know I'm going to get attacked for that, but.
No, I know what you mean. It's one of these things where I have found myself, again, not defending capitalism as it's like set up today in our system, but really being a staunch advocate of local economic ecosystems is the way that we talk about it.
And it's,
you know,
yeah, and it's some, and it's not all, you know, and I think that there's a range, you know, within it. You know, you could use, maybe there will be mutual aid and cooperatives and you know, in condos and just straight up, you know, market rate, you know, stuff. Why does it have to be one thing? It doesn't have to be one thing. It actually shouldn't be. But, you know, but again, I think, but that's like the whole, you know, the value of, I think, you know, and the effectiveness of the roots of this country mean, you know, that essentially tell us that no. If you want money, then you're somehow not like down with the people. That's just so crazy to me, you know.
Right.
That we've been, well, yeah, whatever. Sorry.
Well, it occurred. No, you're exactly. It has always occurred to me that Adam Smith, you know, the Wealth of Nations, the originator of modern economic theory, that when he talks about, you know, the butcher and the candle maker and all these people who are, you know, doing things out of their own to take care of themselves and their families, it has occurred to me that they lived in communities where they would have known every one of their patrons. There was no abstract like McDonald's drive-through where it's just faceless people coming through and a transaction. You actually know someone. And I suspect that there are people who come into your establishment who you don't know, but I suspect you probably get to know them if they come back more than once.
Yeah, definitely. Right? You know, and it's really interesting because it can go both different ways. Like, because I'm from, but I think it's still like, it shows the power of like the nonprofit industrial complex that kind of creates this spirit of this dependency, you know, for people in the community where it's just like, well, since you're from here, like, you know, you should be giving more. And I'm like, this is me giving.
Yes. Amen. I often just try to describe it as people as, you know, when you're on the airplane and they say, if the oxygen mask comes down, you put on your own mask first.
Mm-hmm.
So you can help others.
Right.
You have to do that. You have to put on your own oxygen mask first. I think like our macro capitalist system would say, collect five people's masks and like, you know, have them all to yourself.
Yeah.
To yourself.
Yeah.
But a local community ecosystem is put your own mask on.
Right.
Get healthy. Then go help the person next to you with their mask. And you'll all be better off. Like, I don't see why that's not called capitalism. Cause to me, that's what
it is. I mean, it's right? Like, you know, when capitalism, you know, the foundation of it, yes, created slavery, supported slavery. It also supported Black Wall Streets. And if that wasn't a local living economy, I don't know what was. Like, they had literally had no choice. Because, you know, white folks were like, not going to do business with them. So they were like, okay, we'll do it ourselves. And that's why, you know, many of them, you know, provoke the ire, you know, of white supremacists. It's like, we're going to bomb you into oblivion.
We build a lot of your own wealth.
Yep. Yep. Yep.
I love talking to you. I feel like I could talk to you for the rest of the day. I'm going to ask something of you. If you ever make it up to Minnesota, let me know.
I would love to. Yes.
I would love to have you meet, you know, my neighbors and my community. Likewise, I'm going to look up your place when I next time I'm in the Bronx.
Better. So. You have to. Are you anywhere near Duluth?
Oh, yeah. Duluth is 2 hours away. Yeah. Are you coming to Duluth?
I haven't been. No, but I spent some time in Minnesota. Obviously, it's been a few years, but... But yeah, I was there. I was definitely in the Twins, and I spent some time up in Carlisle, up in Ojibwe territory, and also in Duluth.
Wow, yeah. Beautiful.
Yeah. So well, I got to get back there.
That would be wonderful. The recording we did before, I said, I feel embarrassed pronouncing your name, Majora Carter, because that's my Minnesota Norwegian tongue. You had some other ways to pronounce it that were far more beautiful, but I would really butcher. Would you mind? Just because I want people to hear like the full beauty
you
of your name.
You know, the way my parents, you know, said it. But if you're Spanish speaking, then it would be pronounced Mayora. And if you happen to be French, then or speak French, and then it's Majora. But it's both. We hear both of those languages, you know, in this neighborhood. So I get the chance to hear my name, you know,
in beautiful ways. Very, very amazing. The book is called Reclaiming Your Community. You don't have to move out of your neighborhood to live a better one. If you are someone who lives in a low status community, please get the book, be inspired. Take action. You are amazing. If you are someone who is trying to save a low status community, get some humility and read this book and recognize the heroes that live in these places that we can clear a path for more than anything else. I think you're fascinating. I hope we can do this again.
I hope so. Thank you for having me on Strongtown. Literally, I'm so delighted. I love your work. Thank you.
Well, that means a lot to me. You take care. And thanks everybody for listening. Keep doing what you can to build a strong town. Bye-bye.
by your wife. Trusting there's your guest. Who said that?
They know that America's one big pothole right now.
Build, 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 build. That's the story.
Chuck Marone, this has been fascinating.
Who made the city?
I like you. I like your vision of the world.
The United Nations Earth Summit, Agenda 21. Yeah.